intended for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. For the next hour, I'll be reading from the Triangle Business Journal. Cover story this week, Wolfspeed's time is now. After betting on semiconductors, Wolfspeed's resurrection depends on a plant rising in Siler City. Before the cover story, we'll read the biz section and some of the reporter pages. The biz section is written and compiled by managing editor Dane Huffman. Triangle stumbles toward tourneys. Vendors could get whacked with UNC and NC State facing major snubs in hoops. The Triangle is picking a terrible year for two of its signature programs to be struggling in men's basketball. This year, the ACC tournament returns to Charlotte for the first time since 2019, and the University of North Carolina is always a draw in the Queen City. And in Raleigh, the Lenovo Center will host the first round of games for the NCAA tournament. But despite those appealing locales, the usual surge of enthusiasm and spending by gleeful fans could be muted this year. UNC could fail to reach NCAA play for the second time in 3 years. One measure of meager enthusiasm is that tickets for the upcoming home game against Duke University on March 8th are for sale for as low as $352 apiece. This comes as Chancellor Lee Roberts recently told TBJ to expect a decision on the future of the Smith Center within months. It's a huge decision. Renovating the Smith Center would be costly, with a new roof alone costing up to $100 million. And adding the entertainment district Carolina seeks in that location would be difficult. Two off-campus locations like Friday Center and Carolina North are possibilities, but both, of course, will require funding and donor enthusiasm. By comparison, when Skipper Bowles was shaking the money tree to raise dollars for a new arena in the 1980s, Coach Dean Smith was at the height of his career. As for NC State, Wolfpack fans were howling for fresh T-shirts a year ago as State won the ACC title and reached the Final Four. This year, the Pack may not even make the ACC tournament, as only 15 of the 18 teams are invited. Duke, by comparison, has an exciting team that could contend for a national title, but the Blue Devils have a much smaller local footprint with only 34,000 alumni living in the state. NC State, by comparison, has 39,000 students in its various programs right now. Community colleges launch a new initiative. The North Carolina Community College System is launching a new program aimed at meeting the state's workforce needs. The effort, called NC Community Colleges Boost, is designed to quickly move students into high-demand jobs with high wages. Philanthropic group Arnold Ventures is funding the launch with a $35.6 million grant, marking the largest private grant the state's community college system has received. The community college system will launch the program over the next 2 years, beginning with 8 colleges in 2025 and another 7 in 2026. This includes Wake Technical Community College. The program, according to the system, quote, works through a combination of timely and relevant supports, dedicated advising for students, and incentives to accelerate their education, unquote. More build to rent for Knightdale. More than $51 million in financing has come in for a build-to-rent community in Knightdale. Turnbridge Equities, the developers behind Seaboard Train Station and RUS Bus in Raleigh, has secured a $51.2 million non-recourse loan from an unnamed regional bank for its BTR community. The financing was arranged by JLL Capital Markets. The community is Mailman Post, the company's first BTR project in its portfolio. Mailman Post will have 302 single-family homes for rent on Mailman Road, just north of Interstate 87, south of Knightdale's core. Turnbridge will start vertical construction on the homes in December and will deliver first units in July of 2026. JLL Capital Markets' debt advisory team representing the borrower was led by Paul Spellman, Chris Peck, and Ward Smith. Triangle firm makes a move to the coast. A Triangle firm is making a big move to the Wilmington market. Lee & Associates is opening a new office in Wilmington with Sandy Thorpe as managing director. The office will specialize in retail, office, industrial land, and multifamily. It's an extension of the Lee & Associates Raleigh-Durham office led by CEO Moss Withers and President Ted Boyd. Russell Stewart and Dan Keller of the Triangle office will play an active role in the Wilmington market. And finally in biz, the Umstead tops best hotels list again. Add another win for the Umstead Hotel and Spa in Cary. The luxury lodge for business travelers is once again at the top of a list highlighting the best hotels in North Carolina. The Umstead beat out the old Edwards Inn and Spa in Highlands and the Inn on Biltmore Estate for the top spot on the new ranking from U.S. News & World Report. Notably, the Umstead ranks 73rd nationally, which is impressive given the fact that Cary isn't a vacation destination. Also high on the list is the Farrington House Inn, tucked away between Pittsboro and Chapel Hill. The Cozy Resort is ranked number 4. The first of the reporter pages is Greater Triangle, which is written by Ben Tobin. Hip restaurant sees Clayton expansion. A coffee shop, tiki bar, and restaurant concept is expanding with a second location in Clayton just months after debuting in Durham. Aktun, that's A-A-K-T-U-N, Coffee and Bar is tentatively planning to open in downtown Clayton at 401 East Main Street by the end of this month, according to Oscar Diaz. Diaz, a James Beard Award-nominated chef, is leading the concept along with the group behind the Mezcalito restaurants, which have several locations around the Triangle. The Clayton space was previously occupied by Crawford Cook Shop, owned by acclaimed Raleigh chef Scott Crawford. Diaz said Crawford gave him the heads up that the restaurant space would become available. Crawford Cook Shop closed in October. We didn't really have an idea at the time for what we wanted to do, but then we opened up Aktun in Durham, and we were just really happy with the concept that we did and the outcome of it, Diaz said. And we decided as a group that it would be worth expanding the concept. Aktun in Durham has long hours. On Fridays, the restaurant is open from 7 a.m. to 11 p.m. and serves breakfast, lunch, and dinner. It also offers coffee and cocktails. Diaz did not share revenue figures for the Durham restaurant, which opened in October. Mezcalito, which already has a location in Clayton, has also partnered with Diaz on his Durham restaurant, Little Bull, which opened last year. We really fell in love with this project, he said. We always love everything we do, obviously, but this one just felt a little bit different, a little bit special, so we wanted to give it a shot in Clayton. Greenland push could hit huge NC employer. President Donald Trump's threat of imposing a tariff on Denmark over desires to acquire Greenland has caught the attention of one of the Triangle region's largest employers. Danish pharmaceutical manufacturer Novo Nordisk isn't expressing concern publicly about whether it's worried about its North Carolina operations. Novo Nordisk has around 2,500 workers in the region, primarily at large site in Johnston County. I don't know how those things are going to evolve, Shayla Nunn Jones, Director of Public Affairs for Novo Nordisk, said during a recent Triangle Business Journal event. We're monitoring things like that. Novo Nordisk is working on a $4.1 billion expansion in Clayton to boost its manufacturing capacity for popular weight loss drugs Wegovy and Ozempic. These plants take so long to build that it's really tough to change course, said Emily Field, an equity research analyst with Barclays. In Lee County, a Maryland firm looks to add homes in Sanford. A Maryland-based home builder is adding housing stock in booming Sanford. DRB Group North Carolina, an LLC tied to DRB Homes, formerly known as Dan Ryan Builders, in January purchased 30 lots off Cortland Drive for a neighborhood called The Provisions at Cortland for $3.8 million, according to Lee County deed records. The land sits a few miles from downtown Sanford. According to the DRB Homes website, The Provisions at Cortland will be coming early 2025 and offers 11 different floor plans. The neighborhood will be comprised of single-family homes ranging from 1,577 square feet to 4,462 square feet. There will be a total of 53 homes in the subdivision, according to a plat recorded with Lee County for the subdivision. South Carolina firm targets towns on rim of Triangle. Though based in North Carolina's southern neighbor, residential developer Contender Development is fully invested in the old North State, especially in the Halo counties surrounding the Research Triangle. The developer, headquartered in Greenville, South Carolina, owns or controls roughly 9,000 lots in North Carolina, according to Paul Luck, the company's relatively new division president based out of Raleigh. About 2,000 of those lots are in Sanford, the fast-growing Lee County city. Sanford is going through a renaissance right now, Luck said. I think that the city is looking very close and very hard at what housing ecosystem looks like and what it needs to be for them. Luck said contender like Sanford and other counties around Wake and Durham due to the affordability they provide in Wake County. The estimated average home value is $483,674, while in Lee County that metric is $275,833. Contender also can provide a variety of homes from higher density townhomes to larger lot single family homes, Luck said. None of the flags that we planted in Sanford are the same, Luck said. They each are different. We're trying to be very methodical about what we introduce in Sanford, so it's not that monolithic. In Wilson County, national home builder eyes expansion in Wilson. A large swath of land in a rebounding city in eastern North Carolina was recently purchased by a Greensboro-based LLC, and it may lead to a large residential subdivision. Desco SP LLC bought 113 acres off Westwood Avenue West in Wilson for $4.75 million on January 21st, according to Wilson County deed records. Benson Development Group, based out of Wilson, purchased the land in March 2023 for $1.57 million. On the same day as its purchase, Desco SP signed a deed of trust with D.R. Horton, the nation's largest home builder, as the beneficiary. Amanda Hodiern, a lawyer with Isaacson Sheridan tied to Desco SP and a representative of D.R. Horton, declined to comment on its plans. The land is surrounded by other subdivisions. It appears no subdivision plans have been filed yet for the site. D.R. Horton, which has communities across the Triangle and eastern North Carolina, has already made a splash in Wilson this year. Triangle Business Journal previously reported that the home builder purchased 68 lots for a new neighborhood called Jet Stream Park Phase 3 for more than $4.96 million on January 9th, according to Wilson County deed records. The land is northwest of downtown Wilson off Airport Drive and Airport Boulevard Northwest. Wilson had a population just shy of 48,000, according to the most recent estimates from the U.S. Census Bureau. City leaders are working to grow those numbers through concerted downtown revitalization efforts and recruiting major employers that could bring thousands of jobs to the area. And finally, in Harnett County, Lennar joins home building rush near Lillington. The hub of new housing in Harnett County is set to become bigger with a new subdivision in the works. Millrose Properties, a real estate group recently spun off from Florida-based home builder Lennar, purchased 22 lots in an upcoming subdivision called Caitlin Crossing for roughly $2.6 million on January 31st, according to Harnett County deed records. The land is just north of Lillington and sits off the intersection of Fishing Pier Way and Matthews Road. Lennar spokeswoman Danielle Taco said the community will include 100 townhomes with prices ranging from the high $200,000s to the low $300,000s and 138 single-family detached homes with prices starting in the mid-$300,000s. Homes will open for sale in April per Taco. The median sales prices for a single-family home in Harnett County in January was $341,500, according to Dorify MLS, up about 5% from the same month in 2024. Lennar has been active in planning new subdivisions throughout the Triangle area. For example, Triangle Business Journal reported in May 2024 that Lennar is planning a new 122-home subdivision in Youngsville in Franklin County called Hidden Road, with sales starting this summer. Lauren Onosorge brings us the transportation and development section. The EV sector unfazed by federal pullback. An Israeli company whose electric vehicle technology is used by Shell, Circle K, and Volvo says the pullback by the Trump administration when it comes to EV charging infrastructure won't derail the sector in Raleigh. Drives, that's D-R-I-I-V-Z, which picked Raleigh for its U.S. headquarters last year and has about 10 local employees, is one of multiple EV companies operating in the region, not to mention the massive Toyota EV battery plant south of Greensboro or VinFast's stalled plans for a huge EV assembly plant in Chatham County. Drive's CEO Andrew Bennett puts it into perspective for companies like his. Of the more than 14,000 publicly available EV charging stations added last year, less than 0.1% of those chargers had anything to do with NEVI, N-E-V-I funding. NEVI, the National Electric Vehicle Infrastructure Program, was recently suspended. The U.S. Department of Transportation sent the North Carolina Department of Transportation a letter February 6 suspending the approval of all state electric vehicle infrastructure development plans. In keeping with the federal guidance, the NC Department of Transportation will move forward with construction of the 9 electric vehicle charging stations currently under contract and will suspend additional NEVI activities, an NCDOT spokesperson said. The NEVI program has had a slow rollout, a point hammered home by Trump officials looking to scale back government spending. NCDOT received $109 million in NEVI funds to build out a charging network in the state, which was supposed to occur over 7 years. The suspension stops it in its tracks for now, but it doesn't stop the EV sector, said Bennett, whose company, a subsidiary of Vontier Corp., developed software for EV charging and energy management. The truth of the matter is that it was relatively inconsequential, Bennett said of NEVI. It's certainly going to slow down some of that infrastructure, but it's absolutely not going to stop it, just like it didn't stop it in Europe. They didn't have a NEVI-like program. Lawmakers pushed to stop future tolls on I-95. A bill working its way through the General Assembly would block tolls on Interstate 95 in North Carolina. The legislation called I-95 Toll Prohibition would prohibit tolls on the interstate for 10 years and require prior approval of the General Assembly before any such action is taken in the future. But the reason for the bill is unclear. None of the bill's primary sponsors, State Senators Buck Newton, Benton Sawery, and Lisa Barnes, returned repeated requests to comment on the measure. There are no active plans to put tolls on I-95. Neither the North Carolina Turnpike Authority or the North Carolina Department of Transportation say they were consulted about the proposed law. It's something that's unpopular, and it's not something that's being sought, NCDOT spokesman Andrew Barksdale said, adding that while there had been studies on the possibility years ago, there's no conversation happening regarding tolls on I-95. But there's also no plan for widening the entire stretch, something officials have said could be needed to keep up with interstate traffic volumes. Airlines watch tariffs as new RDU routes near. While the threatened tariffs against Canada and Mexico have been paused, Canadian airlines serving Raleigh-Durham International Airport say they're still watching the situation. RDU has two new nonstop flights to Canada set to take off in 2025. WestJet is scheduled to start service to Calgary in June, and Air Canada wants to expand its RDU service to Vancouver the same month, June. Air Canada already offers nonstop service out of RDU to Montreal and Toronto. The airline enplaned more than 55,000 passengers at RDU in 2024. WestJet is actively reviewing the potential impacts of tariffs and related countermeasures, a WestJet spokesperson said. An Air Canada representative said it's premature to comment as this situation remains a very dynamic situation. RDU has existing service to Mexico, including the Aeromexico nonstop to Mexico City that launched last year. American Airlines and Delta Airlines offer flights to Cancun. It's unclear what the Trump administration's proposed 25% tariffs on imports from Canada and Mexico and any potential retaliation on U.S. products would mean for RDU. But according to the U.S. Travel Association, there's fear that tariffs could impact tourism spending, as Canada is the top source of international visitors to the United States. The retail and restaurants section is brought to us by Kate Tracy. Her main story this week, Raising Cane's to open near NC State. Raising Cane's is strutting into its first Raleigh location. The restaurant chain, known for its chicken fingers with more than 800 locations nationwide, is planning a restaurant at 2420 Hillsborough Street next to Mitch's Tavern and across from the NC State University campus. The company based in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, confirmed the plan is to open in late 2025. The restaurant serves a limited menu of chicken fingers, a chicken sandwich, crinkle-cut fries, Texas toast, coleslaw, and a house dipping sauce. The Raleigh space is 6,450 square feet with a second-story mezzanine bar and rooftop patio. Its most recently was Umami Asian Bistro and Sushi and was once a movie theater and even a bookstore. If the restaurant's reception near NC State is anything like its Chapel Hill debut on Franklin Street, customers could be waiting in long lines to get their chicken fingers. The Chapel Hill restaurant opened in November 2023 and has since expanded into the former Starbucks space next door at 103 East Franklin Street. Jeremy Deckelbaum with Elm Partners represented the landlord, SKS Properties, in lease negotiations for the Raleigh location. The shopping center group represented Raising Cane's. The lease was signed in October. Umami Asian Bistro closed in 2023. Deckelbaum said Umami had been using the location for food preparation for its food trucks and was paying rent until Raising Cane's signed its lease. Umami's restaurant equipment, furniture, and decor are now up for auction. Raising Cane's founder, Todd Graves, recently purchased Jimmy Buffett's Margaritaville property in downtown Nashville, Tennessee, for $75 million. He started the chicken restaurant in 1996 in the college town of Baton Rouge, that's Louisiana State University, and named the restaurant after his dog. The company opened 118 restaurants in 2024 per its website. Raising Cane's has also expanded to the Middle East. North Carolina's other Raising Cane's locations are in Greenville and at Marine Corps Base Camp Lejeune outside Jacksonville on the coast. Children's Boutique pops up in downtown Cary. Downtown Cary has another retail offering, and this one for the kids. After the gift shop Good Day Cary closed its brick-and-mortar store in December at 214 East Chatham Street, a mother of four children has already opened a new children's boutique called Littles of Cary. Countless times I've heard downtown Cary really needed this, or this area really needed this, because there's really not anything like this here in downtown Cary, said Christine Lucas, the owner. Lucas has always wanted to open her own children's store, so she started working with Christina Coffee with Lee & Associates to find the perfect retail location. Wells was on her way to look at a space in downtown Raleigh when Coffee called her to let her know about the available building on East Chatham Street, a busy corridor for traffic and development. I knew as soon as I walked through the door that it would be perfect, Lucas said. Sushi spot to take place of former PDQ in Cary. Chicken tenders are out and sushi is in at a restaurant space in Cary. Azami Ramen and Sushi submitted plans to the town of Cary to open in the former PDQ at 9025 Winston Hill Drive, located at the intersection of High House Road and Davis Drive near Prestonwood Country Club and the Searstone Retirement Community. The restaurant's sample menu included in town documents lists Asian dishes including chicken prawn pad thai for $18, vegetable fried rice for $12, and seafood yaki udon for $18. The menu also features an extensive sushi list, including 16 pieces of sashimi for $28 or a sushi and sashimi combination for $30. The restaurant's floor plan shows a dining room with a table seating and a sunroom with more tables and chairs. Total construction costs for the interior remodel at the building are approximately $20,000, according to the plans. The property on Winston Hill Drive sold in 2022 for $2.75 million to an LLC based in Winston-Salem, per property records. Built in 2013, the building is 4,300 square feet. The registered agent for Azami Ramen and Sushi, Inc. is Key Nee, with an address listed as 3048 Healy Drive in Winston-Salem, where Chinese restaurant Szechuan Palace is located. The owners could not be reached for comment. Ice cream shop expanding to Raleigh. A Durham business serving tasty treats is looking to dip into the downtown Raleigh market. Ice cream shop Simon's Says Dip This is opening this month in a 1,288-square-foot space at 621 Hillsborough Street in the Block 83 in Glenwood South. After sweetening up Durham with their dipped ice cream cones and toppings in 2021, owners Audrey and Nathan Simons thought it was time to bring the business to Raleigh. The menu at Simon Says Dip This features soft-serve vanilla ice cream, 24 dipping sauces, and 30 toppings such as hand-spun cotton candy, pistachios, or fruit. The Downtown Raleigh Alliance approached the husband and wife couple after their debut year in Durham about coming to downtown Raleigh, and the couple began looking for spaces in 2023, Audrey said. The shop's Raleigh neighbors at Block 83 include Yoga 6, First Watch, 321 Coffee, Dram and Draft, Incendiary Brewing Company, and more. It's always great for ice cream shops to be next to restaurants because our busiest time is usually between 7 p.m. to 10 p.m. That's when everybody goes out for dessert, after dinner, or after shows, Audrey said. Nathan has a background in fine dining, having worked at the Farrington House Restaurant and one restaurant in Chapel Hill, M Sushi in Durham, Carrie's Herons, and others. The couple had dreamed of opening an ice cream shop but never seriously pursued it. In 2017, they started a Europe and inspired nut butter business. Audrey found that when she melted the nut spreads and poured it over ice cream, it would set. So the couple decided to pursue their idea for dipped ice cream. The couple owned Simon Says Dip This in downtown Durham in May 2021, and Audrey said the business had a fantastic first year. Ever since then, people are going, "I came all the way from Raleigh. When are you guys going to come next to Raleigh?" It was an obvious natural next location for us, she said. The business brought in approximately $500,000 in revenue last year. The owners worked with Jeremy Deckelbaum with Elm Partners to find their Raleigh retail space. Rent for Block 83 for the ice cream shop is $4,200 per month, Audrey said. They funded the Raleigh expansion through the Durham store's profits as well as family investors and bank loan. The owners are hiring 8 employees for the Raleigh location. Staffing has been the hardest part of running the business, Audrey said, especially because of the seasonal nature of ice cream shops. It's always difficult because we're going to need more people during the summer and fewer people during the winter, so that's always a challenge, she said. In the future, the couple plans to expand in the Triangle. We're envisioning having about 5 or 6 under our belt and then maybe looking into franchising the concept possibly, Audrey said. Here to give us the scoop on higher education is Zach Ezone, Raleigh native named Campbell president. Campbell University has picked a leader from another North Carolina school to be its next president. William Downs will become president of Campbell University in July, replacing longtime president J. Bradley Creed, who will retire in the summer after leading the school for 10 years. Campbell's Board of Trustees elected Downs February 10th to lead the private institution in Buies Creek in Harnett County. Downs has served as president of Gardner-Webb University, a private Christian school in Boiling Springs, since 2019. During his time at Gardner-Webb, Downs led major capital projects, including the construction of a new cafeteria, amphitheater, and an indoor baseball facility, and the renovations of certain academic and athletic spaces. Also during his tenure, Gardner-Webb added new undergraduate and graduate degree programs, revitalized its sports programs, and revived the school's marching band. Downs was previously a college dean and professor at East Carolina University. He spent 17 years as a faculty member at Georgia State University also. Downs is a Raleigh native who earned his bachelor's degree from NC State University. He has a master's and doctorate degrees from Emory University in Georgia. Campbell began searching for its next president last year after Creed in April informed the college of his plans to retire. Creed joined the university as president in 2015 after serving as a dean at the George W. Truett Theological Seminary at Baylor University in Texas. Previously, he was provost and executive vice president of Samford University in Alabama. Creed played an instrumental role in Campbell's growth over the past decade. Campbell completed its largest ever capital campaign under Creed's leadership. In 2016, Campbell began a 5-year campaign that raised $105.7 million, surpassing its initial goal of $75 million. This included 25 donations that exceeded $1 million. Total student enrollment for Campbell in fall of 2024 was around 5,000, including about 2,700 undergraduate students. The school reported about 600 first-year students in the fall, a 6% increase over the previous year. Trump policy would whack UNC and Duke research funding. The research portfolios of Triangle universities could take a massive funding hit under a new Trump administration policy rolled out recently. The administration is pushing to establish a new maximum indirect cost rate for grant funding awarded by the National Institutes of Health. The move would put a 15% cap on the share of funding that can be used to cover indirect expenses, like maintaining buildings or equipment. The change could have a crippling impact for research efforts at UNC Chapel Hill and Duke University. The move caused instant alarm at elite schools across the country, and on February 10th, attorneys general from nearly 24 states, including North Carolina, sued in federal court to stop the measure. A federal judge temporarily blocked the policy from taking effect. Duke has an indirect cost rate for on-campus research of 61.5%, according to information on the university's website. The rate at UNC is 55.5%, the school confirmed. The schools are two of the largest recipients of NIH funding in the country, with Duke receiving grants totaling $580 million and UNC $531 million in fiscal 2024. William Pease to offer free tuition option. Aiming to reach more students, William Peace University in downtown Raleigh has launched a program designed to cover the cost of tuition for certain North Carolina residents. Beginning this fall, the school will cover tuition costs for students who meet certain eligibility requirements. The move, similar to efforts at UNC Chapel Hill and Duke University, comes amid a national decline in the number of high school graduates. Eligible students for the program called the Peace Pledge will have their tuition covered through a combination of federal Pell Grants, North Carolina scholarships, and institutional aids, said Damon Wade, the university's vice president for enrollment, management, and marketing. The institution is guaranteeing that we will support students wherever the gap may present itself after federal and state aid have been applied, Wade said. Eligible students include those who would be first-time traditional undergraduate students who reside in North Carolina. Additionally, the students must come from households with an income of $75,000 or less, as determined by the free application for federal student aid, and be eligible for a federal Pell Grant. The Real Estate and Development section is brought to us by Kaylee Thompson. Garner looks to energize Main Street. A public-private partnership aims to add some vibrancy to downtown Garner as the town explodes with growth. The town is teaming with Florida-based Lansing Melbourne Group to develop Metro 201, a three-story residential building with ground floor retail. Metro 201 will be on 1.7 acres adjacent to the Garner Recreation Center on Main Street. The project is part of the town's efforts to make its core area downtown more vibrant. The building will have 24 apartments, a mix of studio, one- and two-bedroom units, above 10,000 square feet of retail space. The town is looking to have up to three food and beverage retailers in the space, with the potential for a food hall or brewery concept. Peter Flotz, CEO and founder of Lansing Melbourne Group, said the company has been in talks with an Indian restaurant for one of the spaces. There will also be outdoor seating for the retailers, along with the public plaza between the recreation center and the mixed-use building, with public art and community gathering space. Flotz said the company should break ground by the end of this year, with a 14-month construction timeline. The project's estimated cost is $9 million, not including $800,000 the developer has already invested, as this is the third iteration of the project. The development has been in the works since 2020 when the town put out a request for proposals. The goal in general is to take publicly owned property, usually it's a parking lot, and use that to help with the cost of creating housing that's affordable for folks, Flotz said. Rising construction costs made the initial plan untenable. Flotz said the cost for parking garage alone went from $4 million to $7 million. Trump could slash federal real estate footprint. The U.S. General Services Administration, which oversees the federal government's roughly 360 million square foot portfolio, could be a target of the cost reduction efforts led by President Donald Trump. The federal government currently leases 149.39 million square feet of office space across the nation, with rent payments totaling $5.23 billion annually, according to a recent analysis by commercial real estate data firm TREP. An analysis by the Business Journals of a December filing that lists its real estate inventory found 1,715 of the GA's listed leases nationally are set to expire in 2025 and 2026, totaling at least 47 million square feet. In Raleigh, at least two leases, each under 20,000 square feet, will expire in the next 18 months. In Durham, Pfizer sells shuttered facility for $41 million. After sitting empty for more than a year, Pfizer's Durham facility has finally been sold. The pharmaceutical giant sold its Flex building at the Imperial Center for $41.1 million to New York-based investment company, according to Durham County deed records. The more than 80,000-square-foot property at 1219 Shiloh Glen Drive sits between Research Triangle Park and the Raleigh-Durham International Airport. Lightstone's more than $9 billion portfolio includes over 15 million square feet of industrial, life sciences, and commercial properties. In early 2023, Pfizer began looking to offload the Durham facility as part of a shift in the company's research and development strategy. In 2019, Pfizer acquired the property, a shell building built in 2018, for $10 million from Scannell Properties of Indianapolis, according to Durham County Property Records. And finally, in East Raleigh, Country Club moves to block townhomes. Another missing middle housing project in Raleigh faces opposition from its neighbors. The Raleigh Country Club has filed a petition in Wake County Superior Court asking the court to reverse the city's approval of a townhome-style development at 2501 Pool Road in the King Charles neighborhood. The city of Raleigh and local businessman Mark Thompson are listed as the respondents. The petition also asks the court to reverse the project's approval by the city's Board of Adjustments. The project was approved in May 2024. It's just the latest challenge to the city's efforts to attract higher-density residential development in areas that have traditionally held single-family homes. The lot in question backs up to the golf course at Raleigh Country Club. A group of trees separates the property from the 11th Green. Christian Anastasiadis, chief operating officer for McConnell Golf, declined to comment. McConnell Golf is owned by Raleigh entrepreneur John McConnell. In 2023, Thompson filed site plans for Chalens Cottages, a 13-unit cottage court community. The plans have changed since that initial submission. Now the project is for 16 units in 8 buildings. Currently, a single-family home is on a more than 2-acre lot. Now let's turn to our cover story. Chips and challenges. Despite its bold bets, Wolfspeed's future is uncertain. The cover story is by Lauren Onasords this week. Greg Lowe came to Durham to turn Cree around, but instead he lost nearly $2 billion in market capitalization. Lowe, the recently ousted CEO of what's now called Wolfspeed, turned the company on its head. He was a tenured changemaker in the semiconductor space, and during his 7 years at Cree, change was exactly what he'd implement, changing the company's direction and even its name. But the stock tanked, leaving investors scrambling. Today the stakes are higher than ever. Wolfspeed is constructing a $5 billion megafactory in Chatham County, one of the biggest economic development projects in North Carolina history, and the United States is banking that Wolfspeed can help the nation recover the semiconductor dominance it lost to China. But Wolfspeed has to execute, and the demand has to be there when the innovation finally comes off the production lines. Interim CEO Thomas Werner, the former CEO of SunPower and a longtime Wolfspeed board member, was in the room when the call was made on Lowe's future. Now he's dealing with the consequences. The focus on semiconductors, he said, was absolutely the right strategic decision. The timing of the market we did not get right. The market is moving toward us and not away from us, Werner said. We're at the right place. Our timing was more aggressive than what is actually happening. Shortly after his hire, Lowe said his job was to set the vision and remove the obstacles. Once the direction is set, leadership is about helping employees by getting roadblocks out of the way so they can accomplish great things, he said in 2018. Expectations were high. We hired Greg not because he's a one-trick pony, but rather because he's a very experienced, strategically intuitive, broad thinker, then board member John Replogle said at the time. Lowe's predecessor, Chuck Swoboda, was an internal hire, having come on board in 1993 when the newly public company had just over $6 million in revenue. When Swoboda became CEO in 2001, he knew the company line, which was then centered on LEDs. Wolfspeed was just one of the company's business units, encompassing its power and radio frequency business. As opposed to the lighting division, which had banked on consumer LEDs, its projects were complicated and literally less flashy. They were critical to national security and the power grid, yes, but decidedly less sexy to a shopper than the compact LED bulbs on display at Home Depot. But to Lowe, who had spent more than 30 years at two companies in the semiconductor service, the complex technologies behind Wolfspeed were incredibly flashy. He had seen the potential in making complex technologies mainstream and turning around companies in the process. Freescale, which he joined in 2012 after 27 years at Texas Instruments, started as a division of Motorola, developing transistors for car radios in the 1950s. Freescale was in trouble when Lowe took the top spot. Private equity firm Blackstone bought it in 2006 when it was valued at $17.6 billion. Within 5 years, that valuation had dropped to just $4.6 billion. When Lowe arrived, he worked to right both the ship and morale, stripping executives of their lavish offices and putting them to work alongside the rest of their employees. When he joined Cree, he dropped the corporate jet. While his humility was appreciated, there were also initial growing pains illustrated by layoffs. At Freescale, the penny pinching, which included prioritizing units that were winning and deprioritizing some legacy operations, resulted in a good outcome, a buyout by NXP Semiconductors for $12 billion. When with that knowledge, the Wolfspeed board backed his plans. As with Freescale, he would take stock of the entire company and initiate bold change. We'll spend a lot of time digging, and then we'll come out guns a-blazing and moving in a direction that we think has the best opportunity to drive shareholder value, he told analysts on his first earnings call in October 2017. Swoboda had a vision of creating Cree 2.0 as a pure-play lighting company. He tried to sell the Wolfspeed unit entirely, but the deal was blocked over security concerns. Lowe took the opposite approach and divested everything except the Wolfspeed division, creating a pure-play semiconductor company and renaming the company Wolfspeed in 2021. Warner remembers the early discussions in the boardroom 8 years ago, how invigorating it felt with the go-big-or-go-home approach. "If you could predict the future, everything would be so much easier, right?" he said. "I have a phrase I like to use, businesses win in transition." "Some companies win by doing the same thing for a long time," Warner said. "Those markets are called commodity markets," he said. "We are not a commodity market." So he and the rest of the board decided to take the bet. And optimism was high, at least on the outside. After all, semiconductors had been the foundation of Cree when it spun out of NC State University by founding entrepreneurs, including John Palmer, for whom the mega factory in Siler City would later be named. "We have a large multi-decade opportunity ahead of us," Chinggis Balkas, then general manager of the Wolfspeed business, said of the pivot in 2018. But there was internal grumbling as top lighting executives left the company. Some said they had the feeling of whiplash, having gone all in on lighting only to be jerked in the complete opposite direction. While the change in direction was bold, it was slow to realize despite the news releases and bullish statements coming out of the executive suite. Economic developers and politicians swooned over a 2014 visit by President Barack Obama, who had awarded NC State a competitive bid for a $140 million research consortium on the wide bandgap semiconductor technology at the core of Wolfspeed. Cree was part of that consortium's initial pitch. So it seemed natural that Cree would shift its focus toward the technology that could power everything from future electric vehicles to the power grid, innovations where its competitive edge was undeniable. By using silicon carbide instead of traditional silicon, Wolfspeed could create power technology that was smaller, faster, and cheaper. Silicon carbide technology and devices represent a once-in-a-lifetime technology shift, Wolfspeed Chief Technology Officer Elif Balkas would say later. The superior performance of the material unleashes new possibilities and positive changes to the way we live and impacts all industries. And it was the leader of the pack. Electric vehicles were thought to be the vertical with the most potential. After all, with emission targets and growing focus on climate change, the EV industry was set to take off. So Wolfspeed kept raising the stakes of its bet. In 2019, Cree announced plans to sell its lighting division for $310 million to Ideal Industries. In 2021, it changed its name to Wolfspeed to reflect the renewed focus on semiconductors. And in 2023, the transformation was complete when Wolfspeed sold off its radio frequency business to Maycom for $125 million. Wolfspeed was a pure-play silicon carbide company, and there would be no going back in spite of slower-than-expected revenue. When Lowe arrived, he promised that by 2022, revenue from the Wolfspeed unit would displace LED lighting as the core technology, roughly quadrupling in revenue. At the time, the Wolfspeed unit had finished the fiscal year at $221.2 million, just 15% of the company's revenue. When the fiscal year ended last August, it had still failed to quadruple as the total consolidated revenue was $807 million. In the meantime, Wolfspeed was making billion-dollar promises. In 2019, the company announced it would build a $1 billion semiconductor plant near Utica, New York, dubbed Mohawk Valley. To provide materials for the plant, it would need to embark on its biggest project yet, a megafactory. In 2022, alongside Governor Roy Cooper, Lowe announced the White Whale of Economic Development Projects, a $5 billion next-generation materials operation planned for Siler City. Armed with more than $159 million in incentives packages, the factory would create 1,800 jobs. Within days, shovels started moving. The topping out ceremony happened in 2022. Now materials are being sent from there, headed to Durham to be processed. Eventually, they'll be processed on site. But while ceremonies and even a presidential visit was happening in front of the news cameras, aggravation was happening behind the scenes as delay after delay plagued production. Quarter after quarter, executives had to revise their projections, and the stock kept sinking. The market is clearly not valuing the company consistent with our technology, the business we built, or the strategic potential of the business, Lowe told analysts on an earnings call in August. Wolfspeed worked to cut costs to give the EV market time to catch up. It cut 20% of its workforce, and after years of talking up its potential, Wolfspeed even decided to suspend plans for a massive $3 billion plant in Germany. Lowe said at the time that Wolfspeed was holding off anything on that until we get the Mohawk Valley fab fully utilized, but the stock kept dropping. Following his comments that August, the stock dropped 9% to $78.36, far below the high of $139.55 on November 12, 2021, and it kept falling. By last December, for perspective, it sank to under $10 a share. Shares haven't closed above $10 since December 9th. Wolfspeed became a frequent flyer on most shorted stock lists, where investors betting against the company are the ones profiting. As of the end of January, about 27% of its shares were shorted. By the fall of 2024, the board had lost confidence in Lowe and fired him on November 18th. Getting to the mega factory, it was a low priority for him, said Craig Irwin, managing director, senior research analyst at Roth Capital Partners in California, noting it was the long over-reliance on aging infrastructure at Durham facilities that may have been his biggest folly. He was willing to operate Durham off into the horizon, and that is surprising given his history in semiconductor companies. What's not in question was the call to pivot away from LEDs and go full throttle towards semiconductors, he said. There are signals the transition is starting to take hold. As part of its restructuring last year, Wolfspeed transitioned its device business to 200-millimeter silicon carbide. Its earnings, released in January, showed the company topping estimates and reporting smaller-than-expected net losses. Revenue for its second quarter came in at $180.5 million, but stock was still hovering around $6. There are other make-or-break scrambles happening in the background today as Wolfspeed works to execute. In 2024, after years of negotiations behind the scenes, Wolfspeed secured $750 million in grant commitments from the federal Creating Helpful Incentives to Produce Semiconductors, that's CHIPS Act, part of a larger $2.5 billion investment, including tax breaks, meant to support its manufacturing efforts. The goal, at least to Washington, D.C., isn't to salvage Wolfspeed's stock price, but to keep U.S. competitive. U.S. Deputy Secretary of Commerce Don Graves said last year that companies such as Wolfspeed are the nation's best shot at catching up to global competitors in terms of semiconductor production. The U.S. has been losing ground, and never was that more evident than the pandemic and the ensuing supply chain issues that left American manufacturers without a domestic supply of certain critical materials, he said. They didn't have the chips that they needed to keep their production going, Graves said. That meant that consumers didn't have access to what they needed, but it also meant they had to stop their lines and lay people off. We as a country should not be held hostage to other countries and their decisions about whether or not we get chips. But the commitment right now is just on paper. The Trump administration has criticized chips dollars, leaving some uncertainty as to whether it will actually happen, heightened by a temporary funding freeze via executive order in January when the dollars were awarded last October. Lowe said he saw them as an accelerant fuel that would allow Wolfspeed to execute on its plans while maintaining profitability. Werner, however, sees them as critical, saying that without CHIPS dollars, we would expand less aggressively. Even if President Donald Trump leaves the CHIPS dollars unchallenged, Wolfspeed has to earn them, and as Werner said, it's not done until it's done. It's required to strengthen its balance sheet, a directive that includes raising up to $300 million in non-debt capital. Days before Trump's inauguration, Wolfspeed completed the sale of $200 million in shares, a deal that proved it was well on its way. And Werner said he is personally meeting with the CHIPS team at least weekly to ensure that the company is on target with its milestones. He said the nation's competitiveness is a bipartisan issue, and with Wolfspeed's products so critical to both trade and national defense, if anybody should have support in the CHIPS Act, certainly Wolfspeed should be up there. He expects funding disbursement toward the middle of the year if all goes as expected. As for the next CEO, Werner said the company is having high-level talks with candidates, but doesn't have a set time frame for the hire. Irwin predicts the next CEO could come from within. I think they need somebody with a high amount of experience in silicon carbide, said Irwin of Roth Capital Partners. Somebody who understands Wolfspeed impeccably and its strategic strengths and weaknesses. There have been talk of M&A. Could Wolfspeed be bought out? Could it spin off Mohawk Valley? Neither option is likely, Irwin said. The best bet is to keep the hand it gambled on with Lowe and work toward getting Siler City up and running. Wolfspeed will eventually be an American icon, he said. Eventually. We have a guest column this week, Justin Outling. He's a partner and director of diversity and inclusion at Brooks Pierce. And the column is headlined, How Companies Can Keep DEI Practices in a New Era. In a notable about-face from leading corporate America on diversity and inclusion, Walmart announced recently it will stop selling some LGBTQ-related items and stop supporting the Center for Racial Equity. Walmart itself established the organization in 2020 and backed it with $100 million following protests relating to the murder of George Floyd. These reversals beg questions. Why? What are the impacts? And how can companies practice their D&I values, comply with the law, and meet their customers' desires? Changes in law and attitude prompted the shift. In 2023, the U.S. Supreme Court largely agreed with Asian American students who sued Harvard University and the University of North Carolina. They alleged the school's admissions policies discriminated against them by artificially limiting the number of Asian American students. The ruling effectively eliminated affirmative action in college admissions and increased chances courts across the country will strike down other types of D&I programs. Simultaneously, the public hardened on D&I as the issue lay across the front lines of political and social battles. For example, Pew Research found that 42% of Republicans and Republican-leaning workers say focusing on diversity, equity, and inclusion is a bad thing, up from 30% in 2023. North Carolina's public university system largely banned spending on D&I offices and initiatives. Many companies have been the target of consumer campaigns attacking their D&I programs. Companies will have to deal with the likely consequences of their decisions, including backlash from pro-D&I consumers and employees, erosion of progress, assessing diverse talent and changing consumer bases, loss of workplace benefits from D&I, loss of trust in the company's purported values being their actual values. Companies can still practice their D&I values if they manage legal and business risks. First, companies should evaluate whether the Supreme Court's decision on affirmative action in colleges actually affects company D&I programs. The decision could reach companies if, for example, they receive federal funds. Second, companies should review every component of their D&I programs to confirm each is designed to meet its purpose. Third, they should consider modifying programs, mindful of whether modifications provide greater clarity and reduce risk, the costs, financial and otherwise, of the modifications, the trade-offs they are willing to make to prioritize their values, statements they have made regarding their values and programs, who will be affected, as well as their wishes and relative importance to the companies. Companies should engage the likeliest audiences to feel strongly about the programs before making any changes. Such proactive communication dramatically decreases the intensity of negative reactions to changes. Finally, companies should manage expectations. Many people are not aware of or do not care about the underlying legal and business realities that shape policy. Creating an awareness of a new reality while reaffirming commitment to company values is a balancing act that will be needed in this new environment. Should you wish to reach Mr. Outling, you can email him at joutling, that's J-O-U-T-L-I-N-G, at Brooks Pierce, and Pierce is spelled P-I-E-R-C-E, brookspierce.com. Carry Landmark to get retail makeover. The owner of a century-old landmark in downtown Cary is gearing up to turn the house into a retail space. Cary resident Amit Malhotra purchased the Dr. John Pullen Hunter House, located at 311 South Academy Street in 2021, for $1.5 million per Wake County records. Built in 1925, the house received landmark status in 2008. It sits on 0.43 acres next to Cotton House Craft Brewers and the downtown Cary Park. Malhotra decided to sit on the property while the downtown Cary Park came to fruition. Now he's planning to create a food and or beverage destination while also honoring the history of the home and its original chicken coop. We want to make sure that whatever we do with this property, that we respect the historical nature of the chicken coop and the house. And while doing so, we'd like to compliment the park, Malhotra said. The plans add to the change happening in downtown Cary as the area becomes a destination spot. Other historic properties in the downtown area, such as the Williams House, have been remade into retail and food and beverage concepts. Pending town approvals, Malhotra hopes to start construction on the building by the end of the summer. Hunter lived in the craftsman-style bungalow and practiced medicine in Cary from 1920 to 1959. He served as mayor in the 1930s, was president of the Cary Chamber of Commerce, and a member of the Wake County Board of Education. Cary History Ambassador Catherine Laughlin said Hunter served in World War I and helped pay for his medical education by raising chickens, hence the chicken coop. Malhotra, who's 43, and his wife also renovated the Peter Williams House, which dates to 1891, in Raleigh's Prince Hall Historic District. The Hunter property is zoned for mixed use. A law firm leases the 1,800-square-foot main floor. Big number this week, $498,000. Grant amount from Google.org to support North Carolina School of Science and Mathematics Data Science Summer Institute and its Faculty Fellows Program. We've run out of time for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm Hugh Bennett, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Triangle Business Journal is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again, 919-832-5138. So long until next time. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.